Hey, Rabbi Khan, we can start. Everyone, thank you so much for joining today. Rabbi Khan is, I hope I'm his number one groupie. I followed him when I was 19 to Israel because he taught an amazing class on evolution and Genesis, and the rest is history. He's been my teacher. He teaches at Bar Ilan University, and he's the director of the one-year program. You can find a lot of his work at H.com. He's published many, many, many books. My favorite being Explorations, but he's just an inspiration, and the way he views the Torah is unlike any other, and I appreciate him so much giving this class today. So without further ado.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So also, I would like the Shir to be in the memory of somebody who's also a student of mine for many years, Elimelech David Ben Dov Beryl, is here at site tomorrow, and his wife had made a request for people to learn and do things in his memory. So we will do this Lilui Nishmato as well. Okay, let us begin. Not only does Marika claim that she likes the things that I teach, but I know that her favorite topic is Purim, so therefore we'll try to do things which hopefully will be interesting. So, when we gave the title to reveal what is hidden, so first of all, it was a little bit of a play on words with Megillat Esther, because of course Megillat Esther means the scroll of Esther, but the word Esther, the name Esther, also has this connotation of what's hidden, and Megillah can also, it's not what it means, by the way, but it also can have a connotation to be to reveal. So therefore, in a certain sense, Megillat Esther is to reveal what's hidden, and there are many things which are hidden with the story of Esther. What I want to do today is actually try to identify what I think is, and this is, I think, the best term for it, a subtext. It's there. It's staring at us. Chazal certainly were aware that it was there. And when I say aware, I mean they speak about it so much. And for that matter, we know about it. The only thing is, I question to what extent we have ever really worked hard to connect all the dots. I'm not going to claim that we're going to get necessarily to all the dots today, but I want to get to a lot of the dots. So let's begin with certain things which I think are, again, which I think are obvious, and it's things that we know. And as I said, we'll just then try, as we move forward, to try to put them together. So the book begins, or for our purposes, the story begins. Vayehi b'yimei Achashverosh, hu Achashverosh, hamalech madu v'ad kush, sheva esrim u'mea medina. And I'm not going to get that far into that verse itself. Okay, we have a king, apparently a powerful king, apparently a king who rules over many, many places. B'yimim ahim, kishevet ha-melech Achashverosh, ha-kisei malchuto, ashe b'shushan habira. Now, those two words, Shushan Habira, are going to be mentioned many, many times throughout the story. And for us, we need to understand, I believe, what it is that the author of the Megillah is doing, and for that matter, it's something which I believe that Chazal noticed, that there is a certain combination of what I'll call pain and irony, and you can decide which sequence you want this. There's a certain amount of pain that we are in Shushan Habira. There's a certain amount of irony that for us, the capital is Shushan, which means what Jews then, as today, should know, that the capital, when we say the capital, so it could be that for some people, oh, you say the capital, they'll think Washington. The capital, they'll think, no, Yerushalayim is the capital. Yerushalayim is the place where the Jews are supposed to be. And that is going to be the beginning of the problem in this story. Which means we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it's not just the wrong place at the wrong time. We're in the wrong place. We're not supposed to be there. We're supposed to be someplace else. One of the big challenges of understanding the Book of Esther is actually knowing exactly where we are historically, what year it is, what date it is. It's not so simple. And there's lots of discussion regarding the challenges of chronology. But I don't need to know time to know that we're in the wrong place. And let's put it this way. What we can discern is we're someplace between the destruction of the first temple and the completion of the second temple. where we are exactly during that time, as I said, that's the challenge. Which means when you then start to really think about it, so where are we supposed to be? We're supposed to be in Yerushalayim. What are we supposed to be doing in Yerushalayim? We're supposed to be building Yerushalayim. We're supposed to be making sure that the Jewish people continue in Jerusalem. And as we all know, that never happened. The second Beit HaMikdash, the Gemara tells us in Yoma and Daf Tet, was a failure. A failure in the sense that very few people came. But this is even before the failure. This is when the people aren't even there trying to make it happen. And there is reason to suspect that the exact time frame is we started the process and then it was stopped. And now we find ourselves under the rulership of Ahasuerus, and the capital now is not Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been forgotten. Rather, the capital is Shushan. So that is the subtext for the story. Where do we see Chazal making reference to it? So there's a couple of references in Chazal and a couple in the book itself. So let's just, you know, take a look, and then hopefully we'll realize exactly what's going on. In Esther Rabbah, okay, Midrash Rabbah on Esther, Bishalosh Lemolcho Asa Mishteh. After 3 years, he makes a party. So what is the significance of the party? So there's an argument from Rabbi Yehud, Rabbi Nehemiah. Rabbi Nehemiah Amar, he said, Rabbi Nehemiah said, Bishnat Shalosh Lebitul Melechet Beit HaMikdash. It's the third year commemorating that they stopped building the Beit HaMikdash. So as I said, that is one of the suspicions about where we're up to, which means, again, we're not in Yerushalayim Habira, we are in Shushan Habira. And by the way, I'll point out that one of the strange things about Purim is that we have a Purim and we have a Shushan Purim, right? Well, why do we have both of them? Oh, to give honor to Eretz Yisrael. So why do we need to give honor to Eretz Yisrael? Well, apparently there was a dishonor of Eretz Yisrael within the entire story. More than that, what did they choose as the starting point of, or as the criteria to give honor to Eretz Yisrael? They give the criteria of cities that were walled when Yehoshua enters into Eretz Yisrael, which means, don't you realize that we should have been entering into Eretz Yisrael now, just like Yehoshua did? And the Chazal are saying, in case you missed the entire point, we're going to make another day of Shushan Purim for this, so I'm going to say it again. As much as we would like to believe that Purim is a story completely and exclusively about the diaspora, and has absolutely nothing to do about Jews in Israel, I'll insist again, this is the subtext of the story. The subtext is that we're in the wrong place. So therefore, we have one midrash saying, oh, why is even Ahasuerus making a party? Because the building for the Beit HaMikdash ends, and therefore that competition on a certain level, and what kind of competition is it? He's this king of 127 provinces. Nonetheless, that competition on some level has now disappeared or dissipated, and now we no longer have to be concerned about that other place. So that's really what that first midrash is telling us. Right, and it puts in that context. That's the reason why at that particular juncture he makes his party. More than that, again, these are all things that we know. The Gemara tells us in source number 3, Gemara in Megillah, Baharoto et osher kavod malchuto et yikar tiferet. Over here, the Gemara is going to notice that the language is very similar to what we're going to have in this week's parsha regarding the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, where it talks about the et yikar tiferet gedulato and ulachvod ula tafaret regarding the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, and therefore it says, Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Chanina, milamed shalavash bigdei kahuna, that not only was it commemorating the destruction or the non-building of the Beit HaMikdash, is that rather Ahasuerus has in his possession, he has the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. Now, again, there is a linguistic reason to say this, which means there was something which triggered the rabbis, and they said, oh, look, notice the language, but I'm going to say it again. There's a larger theme that they want to point out to us, and we would be making a mistake by only looking at that as an individual occurrence. The other one is most likely the most famous one, and the one that you would have thought of first, and that is Pasuk Zayin, Vashkot B'Klei Zahav V'Kelim Mikelim Shonim, which we even read in a slightly different tune. And what are these Kelim? So we're told in the Midrash, Kelav V'Klei Beit HaMikdash. V'Yuklei Beit HaMikdash Na'im Mikelav. That he has the utensils of the Beit HaMikdash. Which means Chazal just now told us something really interesting. There's a subtext to the story. The subtext of the story is that we are not in Yerushalayim, we are in Shushan. But there is a consciousness of Yerushalayim, there's a consciousness of the Beit HaMikdash, that consciousness is held by Ahasuerus, who, that's the reason he makes the party, and he has the audacity to take the clothing of the Kohen Gadol and to put them on, and he's going to use the utensils from the Beit HaMikdash. So I'm going to say it again. Chazal are telling us something over here, and they're telling us, once again, we could understand the story of Purim and the Book of Esther very well without anything that I just now said. Why? Because all this is a subtext. It's not the text. But the subtext is important nonetheless. And to understand the subtext is really to understand, again, what it is that Chazal wanted us to see over here. And now let's try to move further. The only question will be, along the way, how many sources we get to look at. The picture we'll get, but how many details we'll need, that we'll decide. I did post, and I'll put the link to it, or where you can find the rest of the sources, but we won't go through all of them. Another thing which should be quite obvious to this, and I'm just using, at this point, it was a question of which source articulates it in a way which I liked. Source number six is Rabbi Nassan, who is the major student of Rabbi Nachman from Breslov. And he writes, Shezeh ikar shlemut v'alkein nikra purim al shem hapur shehu hagoral ve'ita shapurim bivchinat yom kippurim. And it's mentioned somewhere, hopefully maybe we'll get to where that is, that Purim is somehow like Yom Kippur. Ki Haman rotza lifgom ba'agoral shel Yom Kippurim. What Haman wanted to do was to destroy the lots that were used on Yom Kippur. And that was the main thing that he was trying to destroy. So now, notice what it is that he's telling us. What he's saying to us is that Haman's objective is quite similar to the things that we had noticed about Ahasuerus, which, by the way, also tells us something that we were never really that sure about. As you read through the book, you don't know what to do with Ahasuerus. Which means it's so easy because we have an evil character in it. We have Haman. So once you have Haman, how much do you need Ahasuerus to be, the main protagonist or the antagonist? Because you already have one. And we're not sure if Haman is exclusively evil and Ahasuerus maybe gets swayed a little bit. But just now realize the way that I'm presenting it, it sounds very much like Haman is evil, but so is Ahasuerus. Which means this concern about the destruction of Jerusalem or the non-building of Jerusalem and the desecration of the temple, desecration of the Kelim, and using the Kohen, clothing the Kohen Gadol. And now you realize that what, again, Chazal are telling us, or in this case, Rabbi Nassan is telling us, about what it is he's trying to do, Purim, which is lots, he's trying to use these lots as opposed to the other lots. Now, I want to point something else about the lots in the Beit HaMikdash, on Yom Kippur, which we can't miss, because if we do miss, then we will not also, again, be appreciating a good part of the subtext. What were the lots for? They were for two goats. One was Lahashem, and the other was Azazel. The Mishnah tells us, Joe, I don't know if you got up to this Mishnah yet, the Mishnah tells us that the two goats have to look as similar as possible. They need to be essentially twins. Same size, same height, same look. They have to look the same. And then one is Lashem and one is Lazazel. So the Balei Machshava, again, we can look in various places to find this. Rav Huttner says it very clearly, that essentially they're twins. In Judaism, who are the main twins that we think of? The main twins would be, obviously, I hope, Yaakov and Esav. Which means, to a certain extent, what is going to be taking place now in this story of Purim is really going to be the story of Yaakov and Esav, perhaps in its most explosive aspect, but it's Yaakov's descendants, Yisrael, and it's Esav's descendants, Amalek and Haman, and therefore specifically to find a source telling us that what Haman wants to destroy are the lots which are done in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Holy of Holies, on Yom Kippur, when the Kohen Gadol is wearing the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, and when he then chooses which is Lashem and which is Lazazel, and of course this is what brings about the forgiveness of the Jewish people. What Chazal are going to be then telling us, again, the subtext of all of this is this party and this eating and this drinking and this celebrating. What in the world are we celebrating? we're celebrating the non-building of the Beit HaMikdash. If you want, by extension, we're celebrating the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Which means all that Haman does is he takes us a little bit further. The various Baalei Machshav who try to understand, so what is it that's taking place by this meal? What is this Seuda, or Mishteh even better? Mishteh has a connotation of drinking, and drinking, of course, has a connotation of wine. And therefore, what they're doing something is a profound sin. And by the way, there's two major sins that we should be thinking of in terms of eating and drinking or celebrating in a way which is inappropriate. The first one takes us all the way back to the Garden of Eden. And there we have, at least according to some of the commentaries, Zohar especially, that the thing that was partook in the Garden of Eden was grapes, which turned into wine, and therefore that is the kind of fruit that confuses you between good and evil. Again, what is the Eitz HaDaat Tov V'Ra? It's something confuses between good and evil. What is that? That comes from grapes. And the other thing would be the sin of the golden calf, which, by the way, ironically is coming up pretty soon as well, which means the Jews sitting and celebrating the non-building of the Beit HaMikdash is not all that far from the chet of the chet ha'egel, sin of the golden calf. And if that's not clear, let me say it in another way, which maybe is a little bit clearer. Why was the first Beit HaMikdash destroyed? So Chazal tell us it was destroyed because of three sins. They were guilty of Gilei Arayot, Shfichat Damim, Avodah Zarah. They were guilty of sexual sins, they were guilty of murder, and they were guilty of idolatry. The sin of the golden calf, Rashi, it's all in one little Rashi. Rashi says, what did they do? Well, it's Avodah Zarah. They worshipped a calf. But what else happened then? Hur tries to stop them. What do? They kill him. So there you have Shfichat Damim. And what does it say then at the end? And Ol Kol Ha'am got up, and they started to kamul tzachek, and Rashi there writes Gilei Arayot. So therefore, according to Rashi, on a very simple level, right, staring at you, the sin of the golden calf has within it all three of those major sins. And what date is it? It's the 17th day of Tammuz. So what's now going to be the echo of this many years later? The walls of Jerusalem are going to be breached. Holy walls will be breached the same way that the Luchot are broken on that day, which means holy rocks given by God, with, you know, written with the hand of God, which then gets destroyed, is going to be really the same concept of the walls of Jerusalem being destroyed. And all of that takes place with that celebration of and worshiping of the golden calf. So I'm going to say it again. These sins are really the major sins, but they're all there within the background of the subtext. What is it that Haman tries to do? Haman tries to get rid of, he tries to destroy the idea of the poor, which means he tries to take the idea of lots and use them in a different way. Use them instead as picking the day of the Jews' destruction, which means who are these Jews? They're Jews who no longer have a Beit HaMikdash. We no longer have the service of Yom Kippur. We no longer have something which will bring about atonement. And by the way, those of you who are not at all convinced that the 17th day of Tammuz and the sin of the golden calf has anything to do with Yom Kippur, what do you think the first Yom Kippur was? It was the day that we were forgiven for the golden calf and for the 17th day of Tammuz, which means, but now we no longer have that means now, again, we're susceptible to total destruction, which means that is what's staring at us when we begin to understand what it is that is the essence of this idea of what Haman is trying to do to us to destroy the Jewish people. Again, all that comes from Rabbi Nassan. He says, you know, a similar thing in Surah 7, Ki Haman ratza lefgomi de hapur v'goral shelo b'goral shel yom kippurim shel tana kohen gadol shnei asirim gorelot gorel echad la'Hashem v'gorel echad la'Azazel. This is exactly the words that I was saying, that one is for God, one is for Azazel. Kedei lechaper avonot Yisrael yedei zedafka. This brings about forgiveness and atonement for the Jewish people. Ki kol avonot, but all sins nimshachim me'etz hadat tovara shehuzu mata nachash. But the reality is, when I told you that we had two choices, either the sin of the golden calf, or we have the sin that took place in the Garden of Eden, he says, no, but these things are actually far more connected than we possibly imagine. One more thing, the Sefer HaLikutim is source number 8, which is from the Arizal. It's going to say some things right now that we're not going to understand completely yet. But when it talks about Vayomer Re'e Reach Beni K'Reach HaSadeh, that when Yaakov walks in dressed as Esav, so let's pause there for a second. If you ever wondered Why is it that we dress up on Purim? The hatred of Haman, which is the hatred of Amalek for the Jews, goes all the way back to when Yaakov dresses up as Esav and takes the bracha. So what are we saying when we dress up on Purim? We're saying we accept what Yaakov did, and we realize Yaakov did the right thing, and we will continue to dress up because we are embracing that decision of Yaakov. So again, those of you who don't understand exactly how it is that we're reading about that particular episode, and one more thing is that he also asks to bring him in a goat, and Chazal do understand that as being a very Yom Kippur type of experience as well, when Yaakov dresses as Esav and goes in to the inner sanctum where he sees Yitzchak. But over here it speaks about the Reach B'ni. So Yaakov is dressed up as Esav. Yitzchak thinks that it's Esav. And he says, oh, I smell that smell, the smell of the field. Which field is that? That's the Rashi tells us, the Garden of Eden. Asher Berchu Hashem, that he smells Gan Eden. Kfar Yadata Adam Arishon of Rabbi Gan Eden. So he says, no, that is what it is that he senses. And I'm not going to read the whole thing right now because I will explain as we move on. Vihiba Amran, one second. And later on, we're told that part of the problem that happens along the way here, you know what, maybe I won't skip as much as I thought, is in Nikwa Sadeshel Tepuchin, Vachakachish Debaha Malach Venavak Imo. Later on, Yaakov gets hurt when he wrestles with the angel. What he hurt is one of Yaakov's legs. In Kabbalistic literature, the two legs are called Netzach and Hod. So it says he hurts his leg, which is related to Netzach. That could have been the end of the world. Again, this is a Kabbalistic source. I'm going to stay away for the most part. But later on, it's going to tell us right over here a couple lines later that therefore Yaakov's bowing down is connected to his hurting his leg, which means it's almost like foreshadowing. Yaakov's going to bow down to Esav. Uviyot sheYaakov ishtachav laEsav esrim v'shtayim pa'amim. V'zeh nirmaz v'megilat Esther shekatuv v'yihi ba'amram elav yom yom v'karinen ke'amram be'amram ke'amram the bet and the kaf l'rmoz kaf bet. Word in the world of the 22, so the Arizal says, oh, that's really because of the 22 times Hishtachavayot, Shishtachavay Yaakov LaEsav. Uvezekav Yechol, Nivnu Kav Bet Otiot LaTorah. They get hurt. Ulachin Lunatakin and Netzach Shayakov. And therefore, Yaakov's leg is hurt, and leg is understood as children, it's understanding the future, and the Netzach, which means, will the Jewish people last? Till somebody from Binyamin comes, which of course is going to be Mordechai and Esther's, and fix it. And what he's telling us is, why is it, again, on a spiritual level, that Mordechai and Esther will be able to be victorious against Haman? It's because Haman's power is from Yaakov's leg, which is hurt. Yaakov's leg, which is hurt, in the real world, that was the night before it hurts, but in the real world, that's Yaakov bowing down to Esav. Yaakov being subservient to Esav gives the power of Haman to be victorious. But there was one son of Yaakov who did not bow down. And this is what the Arizal is telling us. And therefore, the one son who didn't bow down doesn't bow down because he wasn't born yet. And that's Binyamin. That's going to be the beginning of the salvation. But all of this, I'm going to say it again, needs to be understood on a deeper level. And that's what we're going to try to do now. So far, where have we gotten? We have Yerushalayim in the background. We realize that there's the Yaakov and Esav struggle has just come to a whole new level. We realize that Haman and Mordechai is really going back to Yaakov and Esav, but it's going to be different this time for one simple reason. And that is that Mordechai is from Binyamin and not from one of the other tribes, and therefore the subservience is not going to be there, but rather there's going to be victory. So far, those are the elements that we're looking at, and let's try to look a little bit further. The other thing which I skipped along the way here was the Reach HaSadeh, and Gan Eden, all that's going to be really far more significant than we imagine right now. But also remember the very end of the Haftarah that we read on Parshat Zachar was Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, that the Netzach is going to survive, which means Am Yisrael will survive. That even if there's going to be a threat like Haman or Achashverosh, Am Yisrael will survive. And therefore, even though there is a threat there, Am Yisrael survives. I will tell you one more thing about this, and this is only because that somebody here likes explorations, that I did note in a chapter about Yaakov and Esav that the battle that took place between, the meeting that took place between the two, the day that the, all that bowing down took place, it was according to the Zohar on Yom Kippur. And the way that the Zohar learns it, it says right afterwards, it says that Yaakov goes to Sukkot. So the Zohar says, when do you go to Sukkot? You go to Sukkot after Yom Kippur. So therefore, the day that that took place was on Yom Kippur. And the time that they separated from one another was the time of Ne'ilah. But therefore, there's something which is actually very terrible in the story. And again, I want to go back. In the Beit HaMikdash, you know, we read Kol Am Kohenim, when the Kohen Gadol said the name, Hashem HaMefurash, Yotzei Mipi Kohen Gadol, then Kol Am, all the people would be Koreim, Mishtachavim, everybody would bow down. And here in Shushan, we're all bowing down to Haman, which means either we're bowing down where the Kohen Gadol is doing the Avodah, or you're bowing down to Haman, so there's something terribly wrong. But where does the core come from this idea that we even have to bow down to Haman? Well, the core of that goes all the way back to, of course, when Yaakov bows down to Esav. But I'll say it again. There's one son who doesn't bow down. Yaakov and the whole family bow down. That means that there's one hope for salvation, and we'll again have to understand where that's coming from and how exactly that works. And now you realize again on a deeper level that the day that Yaakov bows down to Esav is on Yom Kippur. Now you realize that Yom Kippur, at least at that point, had no power to it. Of course, the fact that Yaakov gave matanot, he gave presents to Esav, according to the Ramban, based on the Pirkei Avot Elezer, is going to later on be the very idea of the Seir La'Azazel, so maybe there will be hope, but there's something which is very deflating. And Chazal get very upset with the idea that Yaakov bows down to Esav, because that's what gives this terrible power of Haman to enjoy the power over Yaakov or over Israel. So I hope all of that made sense, and if it did, then we can go on. Source 9. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan HaBira. So right there, there is a little bit of irony, because the place that an Ish Yehudi should be, of course, is in Yerushalayim HaBira. But Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan HaBira. Ushma Mordechai. Now Mordechai is also something to pay attention to. It is not a terribly Jewish name. Those of us know a little bit about, and it could be Persian, it could be Iranian, but it could be connected to Marduk. I mean, it is not the name that a Jewish man should have, which is now actually real, even more painful. But what happens when we end up in places we shouldn't be? We end up with names that we shouldn't have. He's Mordechai ben Yair, ben Shimi, ben Kish, Ishimini. Now, we're going to go back and pay attention that we don't know who he is, because he's Ish Yehudi, but he's Ish Yemini. And the Gemara is going to ask about this. Make up your mind. Who is he? Is he Yehudi or is he Yemini? But then we're told the problem. Ashei Haglabi Yerushalayim. Again, this could be said with a sad tune, that he was exiled from Yerushalayim. And here you see finally Yerushalayim being mentioned. That's the irony. That is the contrast. Ish Yehudi is in Shushan HaBira and not where he's supposed to be. Not in Yerushalayim, but he went to exile, Imagola Shal Glata, and he goes off into this exile, and together with him, V'yihi Omein Et Hadasahi Esther Bat Dodo. By the way, everybody seems to get this wrong. Bat Dodo means the daughter of his uncle, which means their cousins is their relationship. Ke'en La'avaim, she has no parents. V'nar Yifator V'tovat Mareh, and she was very attractive. U'vamota V'yo V'ima, and when her parents died, L'cha Mordechai Lo Levat, Mordechai adopted her as a daughter. And there's some rabbis who give this connotation, perhaps even as a wife. So again, what I wanted you to note over here is the Shushan HaBira is the wrong place. We're there because of exile. Everything which I suggested earlier is actually staring at us in this part over here when we get the contrast between these two places. Esther also is also not a terribly Jewish name, more connected to Ishtar. So you have two nice Jewish people, Marduk and Ishtar, who are stuck off in the wrong place. They're off in exile. They're off in Shushan HaBira. They're in the wrong place. And again, that's a story. But here comes a little deeper point. Ish Yehudi and Ish Yemini. So the Gemara has trouble with this. The Gemara says, hold it, Kori Le Yehudi v'Kori Le Yemini. So which is it? And we use the word Yehudi to mean a Jew, which the Gemara does as well. But the pshat of what Yehudi would mean is from Yehuda. The pshat of Yemini, what that would mean, is from Binyamin. So now the question is, which tribe is he from? And we actually know that Yehuda and Binyamin were two tribes that were very close to one another. And it's saying, well, where was he from? And it plays with these different kinds of ideas. Is he fundamentally somebody from Yehuda who lives in Binyamin? Or is he from Binyamin who lives in Yehuda? And some of you now can say to me, so what difference does it really make? And that's this whole discussion, the Gemara, trying to figure out, you know, exactly who he is, which then will tell us a little bit about what he is. So I'll just point out one little thing about Mordechai and about being an Ish Yehudi and an Ish Yemani. There was, once upon a time, we had something which was called the Beit HaMikdash. Question, where did the Beit HaMikdash stand? What exactly was the location of the Beit HaMikdash? Look at source 31. Maya bechelkol sheyuda harabayit. Which means the Beit HaMikdash itself straddled Yehuda and Binyamin. And what was in Binyamin? The Holy of Holies. So now I want to pause, because now you realize that maybe we've been reading the identity of Mordechai wrong till now. Who is Mordechai? He's Ish Yehudi and he's Ish Yemani. He represents Yerushalayim. He is Yerushalayim. He represents the Beit HaMikdash. He represents the Holy of Holies. Which means when you realize that being an Ish Yehudi and Ish Yemini combines those two elements, you now realize what kind of power is there and what can be utilized. But as I said, all of this is the subtext. We're far away from Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim has been destroyed and has not been rebuilt. The Kohen Gadol's clothing are being worn by Achashverosh. The poor, which the Kohen Gadol, the lots that were done in Yom Kippur, now he's using them in order to try to destroy the Jewish people. The Kelim, the utensils in the Beit HaMikdash, are being utilized to celebrate the party. The Jews are participating in the party, which somehow reminds us of both the sin in the Garden of Eden and the sin of eating from the golden calf, and therefore instead of mourning over the loss and trying to do something about building Yerushalayim, what the Jews are doing instead are being, you know, for whatever reason, maybe they feel that they're like everybody else and they want to be good citizens and they want to fit in, but now they're with everybody else celebrating the non-building of Jerusalem, and the capital is Shushan, and Jerusalem is all but forgotten. But there's one person. And by the way, every single time I say there's one person, I want you to realize there's really two people. Because the one person who I'm going to identify is Mordechai, because he's an Ish Yemini and an Ish Yehudi. But there's actually another person who's even more hidden, and that other person is Esther. And Esther's very identity is being hidden. Esther is Ani Hastir Astir Panai. She is this person who is hidden, which means I'm going to talk about Mordechai, but every time I say Mordechai, I want you to understand something. It's at least Mordechai, but there's somebody else there behind the scenes that is actually the real hero of the story. But we know what happens next. Haman sees himself as being a god. Haman tries to get everybody to bow down to him. And there's one person, one Jew, or if you want, one Yemini, who absolutely refuses. Now, all of us have no doubt whatsoever what the headline in Haaretz would be, right, the next day. It would be, look at this Mordechai who just now endangered the entire Jewish people by being so stubborn. Why can't he just follow the rules? Why can't he do what's expected of him? Why can't he just do the right thing? And what ends up happening because of his being stubborn, the entire Jewish people are going to be in danger. So now, with that nice long introduction, I want to read a Gemara, which is almost the place that I was going to start today, but I decided to give you your introduction first. So now we can read the Gemara. The Gemara asks what sounds like four very funny questions. It starts with source 11, Moshe Minatar Minayin. How do we ever know there would be a person like Moshe from the Torah? And you have to hear that question and say, like, by the way, is that Purim Torah? What are you talking about? How many times does it say Moshe in the Torah? Now just pause there for a second. We'll play along and read. Bishagam hu basar. We have no idea what it's talking about. We'll look at Rashi. He'll help us. But then the Gemara is going to ask about three other people. And then we're going to be more intrigued. Haman min haTorah minayin. How do we know from the Torah there would be a man like Haman? And it says Hamin haEtz. It says from the tree. Which tree? Oh, the tree it's talking about is when God says, did you eat from the tree? Talking to Adam and Eve. Did you eat from the tree that I told you not to eat from? That's the Eitz HaDaat Tov V'ra. That Haman's identity goes back to eating from the tree, which, by the way, really tells us that his identity goes back to the Nachash, goes back to the serpent. So therefore, that's far more interesting. The other next character to ask about Esther min haTorah minayin. How do we ever know there would be an Esther? It says, V'nochi Esther, Esther, because I will hide myself. Mordechai min haTorah minayin, and this is also a little difficult, Dichtiv mor dror, because it says that it's going to be this incense. Mitargaminon, but the Targum writes, Onkelos writes, Miradachia. So it sort of sounds like Mordechai, and you, again, I'm going to say you have no idea what we're reading here. It sounds almost like Purim Torah, but Moshe, we don't understand at all. And the other three names are all part of the Purim story. So there's a Purim story with a Moshe in the background, and I'll say it again, we're not sure what to do with it. I'll tell you in a second what I believe to be the connection between these four individuals. Rashi explains, Bishagam hu, Bishagam, Bigamatria is Moshe. By the way, the continuation of that verse is that he will live for 120 years. Let me first tell you, though, what I think is the common denominator of these four people. Moshe, Haman, Mordechai, and Esther all are connected to idolatry. So I don't know which of those bother you the most. I assume it should be Moshe. In Egypt, we're told that they worshipped, well, they saw Paro as being the god of the Nile. That's a pasuk in Yechezkel. Li ori, v'niasetini. The Nile is mine, and I created it. Paro is the god of the Nile. Paro's daughter, who's Bithya, the daughter of a god, by the way, which is interesting, she says she finds Moshe in the water. I took him out of the water. So therefore, if she took him out of the water, she's claiming that the water gave birth to him. Which means Moshe, as perceived by the average Egyptian, he was seen as some kind of a god in Egypt. Hold on a second. I already gave you two of them. I actually already gave you all three of the three. Marduk is considered to be a god in antiquity. Ishtar is considered to be a god. Haman saw himself as being a god, made people bow down to him. What's the verse that I quoted with Moshe? Bishagam, which says Gematria is Moshe. And it says, Bishagam u'basar, that man is made of flesh and blood, and he will live for 120 years. Which means that man is flesh and blood. Even Moshe Rabbeinu is a person. It's fascinating that Judaism never crossed that threshold into this phenomenal mistake to say, turn Moshe into a god. We always kept Moshe as Moshe. We didn't go over and make that mistake. But this whole Gemara is actually then telling us that we have four people who we need to see their essence from the Torah. By the way, there's actually halach in Shulchan Aruch that you're not allowed to say the name of an idolatry unless it's written in the Torah. It's written in the Shulchan Aruch. So that's very likely the background of this when it asks, how do we see these people in the Torah? So therefore, all these people that there was a suspicion. Now, who's the one that we're most concerned with? It's obviously Esav. Sorry, it's obviously Haman. Haman claims that he is a god. Why am I saying this? Because he makes everybody bow down to him. There is significance to this. Who is the one who refuses to bow down to him? It's Mordechai, which means Mordechai is the one who will not bow down. Which, again, is somebody wrote me a note, to everybody, he's absolutely correct, that Ishtar is the morning star, and that is Alot HaShachar, and their Midrash, and the Gemara says, that's actually the Shir Shoyom that we will say on Purim, which means they understand absolutely what the name Esther really is, and therefore it's Lama Netzach Aliyelot HaShachar. Absolutely, the morning star is connected to Esther and to Ishtar. Clearly correct. Source 13 is the verse about Moshe, Bishagam hu basar, v'yu yamav me'ev v'sum shana. Even Moshe will only live for 120 years. The verse regarding Haman is Hamin Ha'etz. Did you really eat from this tree? The verse regarding Esther was Vani Astir Astir Panai. I will hide myself, which is actually quite interesting because the story of Esther takes place when God is in hiding. It's Hester Panim. God does not speak in the book of Esther. God doesn't tell people what to do. They have to try to figure it out themselves. And finally, with Mordechai, we see that the idea is this Mordror, which again is this idea of this incense which was used. So, let me try to make more sense. Just quickly, source 18 tells us Mordechai's real name was Petachia, if we didn't know. And source 19 tells us Moshe's real name was Tuvia, just in case we don't know. And Esther's real name was Hadassah. So therefore, all of these names are different names. But keep in mind Hadassah, because that is a significant name. And even Memuchan, Zehaman, maybe even he has a different name. Part of what I said about the names is in 22 in the Yerod Dvash. But let us now try to understand this, hopefully, a little bit better. There's a teaching that I want to share with you, which is source 26, first Rashi says, he made everyone bow down, sha'asa atzmo eloha. He turned himself into a god. But Mordechai is the one who refuses to do this. He refuses to bow down. It's also, by the way, taught that everyone else participated in the Seuda. This is source 29. Everyone eats and drinks during this. So Mordechai lo achali mahem v'lo shatach l'kach nikra ish Yehudi. Mordechai is the one that doesn't eat, and he's the one that doesn't bow down. Source 28 goes a little bit into this idea of him not bowing down. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh, which means he will never bow down. He would never bow down to Haman. So listen to the conversation in source 28 in this midrash. Mara ita shatamavatel klavasin shamelach. How can you ignore the instructions of the king? Amalei shani Yehudi. He says, I'm a Yehudi. Amalei v'lo matzinu shabatech ishtachavu levoteinu. Haman says, but your ancestors bow down to my ancestor, which means the brothers all bow down to Esav. Shenemar v'ishtachavu arta sheva pamim. And it quotes the verse regarding bowing down to Esav. Amar le binyamin avi bimei imo haya v'lo ishtachaveh. Binyamin was in utero and he did not bow down. Vani ben beno shenemar ish yemini. Ukeshem shelo kara avi, kach lo echra lecha, lekach nemar Mordechai lo yichra velo yishtachaveh. So far what we're seeing is that everybody bows down, but there's one person who doesn't, and that's Mordechai. And we've already seen this, because his father or ancestor Binyamin doesn't, he doesn't have to. So now, note a teaching of the Bnei Yisachar, or perhaps the way he would have pronounced the Bnei Yisachar. He's also one of the Hasidish, important Hasidish books. And he tells us a couple of things that maybe we didn't know and maybe we didn't even begin to think about or to imagine. He tells us about, first of all, about the month of Adar. He talks about Purim and the poor and so on, but I want to look at the... Yeah, so look in the third line. V'nitpareh shama pi haktamat maran ha'arizal, diber b'kodsho kol ha'chadushimi b'chinat evorei ha'rosh. All the different months are somehow connected to different parts of the body. Tishrei is the skull, Mar Cheshvan are the ears, Tevet are the eyes, Adar b'chinat ha'chotem. Adar is connected to the nose. Botalei chush ha'reach, and that's connected to the sense of smell. And then he tells us something which we need to pay attention to, but he says it more than once. So let's go down a little bit further when he, if you want, we can read it first here. But he writes it once. Let's look at it over here, the next paragraph. Uvizet titponein flaot tamim deim. Hinem Haman rasha hatzar tzarer haya kochol min hanachash hakadmoni. Haman's power was like the power going all the way back to the nachash. A couple of months ago, I gave a class, some of the people here were there, when I spoke about Esav having a tattoo of a nachash on him, which was which apparently is connected to Haman as well. Esav was connected to the nachash, Haman is connected to the nachash, and that is Hamin Ha'etz. Who got us to eat from that tree? It was the Nachash. Haman is connected to this tree. Asher pita lecho min ha'etz hadat, which seduced us into eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And that's the same idea of seducing the Jews into eating the meal from Achashverosh. And again, that's the connection. But remember, that's not where we're going with this. He somehow is going to explain how this is connected to smell. And therefore the Jews, that's a term talk of the Jews therefore almost were destroyed because of this. And the sin of Adam was in a sense resuscitated, and therefore death was going to come back to the world. Which means the sin of Adam was forgiven, most likely, by the time the Jews stood by Harsinai. We stood by Harsinai, accepted the Torah, and then the world was good again. But then we sinned with the golden calf. Over here, we have the same kind of sin coming back, eating by the Seuda of Achashverosh, celebrating the non-building of the Beit HaMikdash. But Ikenas Aleihem Mita, Kamo Al Adam HaRishon B'Chlo Min Eitz Hadat. But then he continues and he tells us something interesting. Vinei pa'al v'asayotze kol hu elokeinu. Let's just see a little bit more. Asher hamana rashahi pilpu la'abed v'lo matza logrena rach chodesh adar. And what month does he find? He uses the lots and he picks adar. Hu b'chinat achotem. And that is the month that represents the nose. Asher bochu shareach, which represents the sense of smell. V'hu chush hamitkayem ki lo nifgam b'cheta adam rishon. And that is the sense that was never impacted by the sin of Adam. Now, in case we didn't understand what he just now said, go back and look at the previous source, in source 39, where he has the similar ideas, and look at by Yud, section Yud here. When it comes to Adam, by the way, the Bnei Yisachar says this at least 8 different times. That's why we're only looking at 2 of them. He says, by Adam, all the senses were corrupted. And all of them were used in the sin. That's Re'ya. She sees the tree. She takes it. That's touch. She eats it. That's tam. That's sense of taste. She listens. That's shema. That's the ears. But the one sense that was never corrupted was the sense of smell. The sense of smell was the only sense that wasn't corrupted in the Garden of Eden. So now, let's try to make sense out of everything that we've seen, and believe it or not, I think it really will make sense. Corruption all over. The one person who's not corrupted is Mordechai. Mordechai doesn't bow down. Why? Because Mordechai's from Binyamin. Binyamin never bowed down, so therefore Mordechai doesn't have to bow down. Who is Mordechai? He's Ish Yehudi and Ish Yemini. What does that represent? That represents the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies, but it's destroyed. It hasn't been rebuilt. No, there's still Mordechai. Mordechai is the one thing that was never corrupted. Mordechai, therefore, represents the one smell that was never corrupted, or the one sense that was never corrupted. What's the one sense that was never corrupted? That's the sense of smell. So when the Gemara asks Mordechai Minatar Minayin, and then pick this verse, Mor Doror, what does mor dror mean? Mor is a sense, is incense, dror. This is a type of incense. By the way, if you just want the letters, mor, mem, resh, is gematria Amalek. Dror, 240, is Amalek. Dror means freedom. Mor dror is freedom from Amalek. What is the secret, though, of the freedom from Amalek? It is this idea that the sense of smell, which was never corrupted by the serpent all the way back in the Garden of Eden, that's where purity comes from. What did the Kohen Gadol do when he went into the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur? He took the Torah with him. He took the scent, which represents smell, which means the one place that was never corrupted is the place that all the healing comes from. But I want to point out something, you know, even perhaps more surprising, about the Ketoret. The Gemara tells us that when it comes to the recipe about how you make the Ketoret, it says something which perhaps is a little surprising. Look at source 23, Gemara in Kritut. Amar of Chana Bar Bizna, Amar B'Shem Chasida, Kol Tanit She'en Me Miposhe Yisrael Eino Tanit. Because if the Jews are going to have a day of fasting, you need some sinners to be there. If only Tzadikim fast, what's the purpose of Tzadikim fast? Nothing got changed. You need some good sinners in the shul as well. Every shul needs a couple of good sinners. Otherwise, it's not a, you know, again, what has been accomplished? Sherei chil bana, because when it comes to the recipe of making the ktoret, one of the things it has with chelbana, recha ra, it had a terrible smell. Umana katuv bin samanei ktoret. Nonetheless, it is enumerated among one of the ingredients of the ktoret. So there's something really profound here. The way the ktoret works is by taking something that smells terrible and then covering it up with a sweet smell. That, by the way, is the idea of tshuva. The idea of tshuva is you take something which is really bad and then you cover it up with something which is really good, and you take sin and then you elevate it into something which is the service of God, and somehow you have been able to turn the world around. This is represented by the ktoret. But again, the ktoret is the one thing that was never corrupted. Mordechai represents the ktoret. Mordechai is the mordror. Mordechai is the incense. So therefore, Mordechai, as the one thing that and he's from Binyamin, and he represents the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and he therefore never bows down, and he doesn't eat from the party. And therefore, he ultimately will be able to be victorious against Haman, because if Haman represents the serpent, and the serpent caused all of this sin, but there's one place of purity, that's Mordechai, that's where victory or salvation will come from. But I told you there's a deeper level to all this. The deeper level is that there's another person who represents the sense of smell, and that is Esther. Why? Because Esther's not her real name. What's her real name? It's Hadassah. What is a Hadass? Hadass is one of the things that we use on Sukkot. It's a thing which has a pleasant smell. Many people use the Hadassim. They use it all year for Havdalah. And by the way, in the B'nai Yisachar, where he talks about the sense of smell, he talks about Havdalah, and he talks about the Hadas, and so on. Which means you have two people who are both Yemini and Yehudi, who represent the Holy of Holies, where there's no corruption, where it represent the sense of smell, and they're the ones who are going to be able to defeat Haman. But why? Because even though the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, there's still something here that represents purity, and from that purity is where the salvation will come. And it's from here that I have to, again, mention one more source, and then we'll stop, and if there are questions, I'll be happy to try to answer. And that is the incredibly remarkable Tikkuni Zohar, which speaks about the Kohen Gadol. Now, many, many people have written about this idea of Purim and Yom Kippur somehow being connected to one another. Yom Kippurim, right? Purim, Yom Kippurim. Yom Kippur is never called Yom Kippur in the Torah. It's always called Yom Kippurim. So there is this analogy, Yom Kippurim, a day like Purim. Purim and Yom Kippur are somehow connected. So I'll say it again. There are many, many, many teachings of this. How many of us, though, have seen the first, what I'll say, the original teaching about this, which means the one which was originally the source of the idea. So let's take a look. It's written in the Tikkuni Zohar, and the truth is we could have had the whole class based upon this, but let's take a look. V'yu Yom Kippurim, and this is Yom Kippur. And what happens in Yom Kippur? On that day, the Kohen Gadol dresses in beautiful clothing. What makes the clothing beautiful? The inu levushe kapara, that this is clothing of atonement. It karet tzitz delay, and therefore he wears the tzitz, umet snefet delay, avnet delay, iu kalila ma'arba bigdei lovin, misitra diyamina. It includes the four white garments, which are represented by the right side, of arba bigdei zahav, misitra desmola, and the four clothing things that, which are from gold, which represent the left side. These are more Kabbalistic ideas. But who zimna, the it kishtat be'ilen levushin de kapara it marba, and in the moment that the Kohen Gadol wears the clothing which represents atonement, what verse to be applied to this? The most surprising verse it could possibly bring. The Tilbosh Esther Malchut. That's what it means when Esther put on the royal clothing. That's talking about when Esther's about to go in and see the king. And at that moment, she's about to go inside to the inner sanctum. Now this is remarkable, because we're talking about two things at once the Zohar is able to talk about. Esther putting on her clothing, where she's going to try to be on the good side of the king, And they say, no, that's really the same idea of the Kohen Gadol walking into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, uvahona sachein be'enav, and then she will, you know, get favor, right, in the eyes of the king. V'raz demil avritil l'skor brit olam, v'idei Hashem shema, Hashem slacha, Hashem akshiva, v'asei al ta'acher. And that's where all forgiveness comes from. Purim itkreit, Hashem ha-yom ha-kippurim. And that's why Purim is connected to Yom Kippur. So this is something that we still need to understand. As much as I was saying is that behind, you know, the scenes, the subtext is Yerushalayim, and the subtext is this idea that there was this celebration, and it's the utensils, and it's the kelim, and it's the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. The Zohar just now had the audacity to say that when Esther goes inside to see the king, she has a status of a Kohen Gadol. She is the Kohen Gadol. And by the way, I absolutely believe the Zohar is true in the sense of her emotional sense at the time. She, just like the Kohen Gadol walks into the Holy of Holies, having on his shoulders the sins of the entire Jewish people, their future on his shoulders, he needs to perform everything in the proper way, or what will the future hold for them or for us? Esther walking in to see the king has the exact same emotional experience. She's walking in with really the plight of the entire Jewish people on her shoulders. And that's what's so interesting about the Zohar. It's saying that Esther is the Kohen Gadol. Esther is functioning as a Kohen Gadol. But we've already noted that Mordechai represents the Ketoret, the incense. Esther represents the incense. Now, the difference between the two of them, and maybe that's something that we really need to focus on, is, and again, with this will come to the end, that when we read the story of Esther, so I could say Mordechai remains pure. Mordechai never bows down. Mordechai doesn't eat. But Esther ends up becoming the queen, and she ends up having to live together with this man. She ends up sleeping with Ahasuerus. And we can look at her and say, well, look how tainted she was, and look at the things that she had to do. And the Zohar is telling us, please do not misunderstand what Esther is, because Esther's emotional state going in to save the Jewish people is one of the Ketoret, the place that the Ketoret, this thing that is never corrupted. She is the Kohen Gadol. She is Yehudi and Yemini. She is the Holy of Holies. And therefore, the entire subtext of this story is the destruction of Jerusalem or the lack of rebuilding of Jerusalem. And you're saying Esther is, again, part of the problem. No. Esther is actually the rebuilding of Jerusalem is going to come from Esther. And then the last thought for today, especially because Purim is coming, and we have to get to the point that we can bless Haman. I don't want to say we curse Mordechai. Curse Mordechai for not bowing down, but we have to bless Haman. How do we bless Haman? Because Chazal tell us that all the money that Haman collected ended up going over to Esther. And all the money that Esther ended up getting over from Haman, she ended up sending over to build the Beit HaMikdash. Which means, who was the one that we should put the plaque on? The Beit HaMikdash was built by who? It was by Haman. And Maharal says this. He says, listen, people like Haman have an easier time collecting money than Jews do. Jews don't have all the same amount of time. We have to learn Daf Yomi. We have to go to shul 3 times a day. We have to go and be good husbands and be good fathers or be good wives and be good daughters. And we have to be good, decent people. We don't have the time to go get money in the way that Haman can collect money. And it says that Haman collected all of this money, and what happened to Haman's money? Haman's money moves over and ends up in Esther's hands. And Esther ends up taking all of this money and sending it over. And again, the Maharal is saying, literally, the Beit HaMikdash was rebuilt with all the money of Haman. So therefore, blessed is Haman, blessed is Esther, even blessed is Mordechai. And I'll say it again, there's a subtext to the story. The subtext to the story of Purim is Yerushalayim. The subtext to the story of Purim is Yaakov and Esav. The subtext is the Nachash. All of these elements are there in the background, and the subtext is Yom Kippur. And therefore, once you understand that that's what's taking place in the background, then you begin to understand what really is taking place, not just in the subtext, but in the text itself. So, Marika, are you back in charge, or...
Rabbi, that was amazing. You made my Adar and definitely enhanced my recovery. And thank you for teaching everyone.
And Marika, you should have refuah shlema b'toch kol am chabei Beit Yisrael. Anybody who's ill and needs refuah, Refuat HaNefesh, Refuat HaGuf. Also Refuat Kalkalit. Also, anybody who needs a refuah should have a refuah Bezrat Hashem.
You can maybe unmute everybody in case they have any questions.
There you go.
Rabbi, this is Sammy Simnagar. Thank you for a great shiur. I'm curious, the idea of, you explained how we're supposed to drink until we don't know the difference between blessed is Mordechai and cursed is Haman, until the opposite. What's the cursed is Mordechai part? What is that?
Mordechai should have bowed down, because he didn't bow down. We were almost all killed. What kind of behavior is that? Sometimes you got to be pragmatic. Sammy, you know that more than anybody, right? Sometimes you have to be pragmatic.
But in retrospect, he did the right thing, right?
In retrospect, he did the right thing, even though it happens to be among the Achronim, they debate it. They say, well, did he really? Maybe he could have bowed down. It's very interesting. The halachic aspect of this is interesting.
Rabbi, but the whole thing is, how can we also side with Haris? I guess they can be right once in a while, right?
Yeah, but it's an accident. Lo kol yom purim, as we say in Israel.
Thank you.
Sammy, it's good to see you and your wife. One of these days, we'll make it back to Boston.
We would love to have you back. We can't wait. Bezrat Hashem.
Bezrat Hashem.
The Kohen Gadol actually goes into the Kodesh Kodeshim with the Ketores.
Right.
Is it tacit that Mordechai was accompanying Esther when she went in to see the king?
It's tacit emotionally. He's with her. His prayers are with her.
All right.
His wishes are with her.
He didn't actually ordain that she should. It was her initiative,
correct,
wasn't it?
Correct.
All right.
As I said, she's the hero. He maybe gets a little of the credit, but she's the hero.
Question?
Please.
When he says that Esther denied all the aspects of beautification, like perfume and all that stuff, does it have to do anything with that Ketoret idea? And by the way, I have to tell you, I think I've learned, and I have learned about Purim a lot, like through the years, through many, many, many years. And I have never learned so much in 1 hour about Purim. Like, so obscure, so cool. You're like the coolest rabbi ever. Like, seriously, the stuff you bring up blew my mind. I was like, what? 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 It was so good. Thank you.
Well, Raina, so, first of all, before you go any further, I just have to say to you, that I have a Persian daughter-in-law, and my wife makes Persian rice now, tagid, because of you. She makes it like once every other week or something, and we are blessed because of you. Continue. Go ahead.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you. Thank you for telling me. So I was wondering, like, if that has anything to do with, the whole Ketoret thing. And then, like, I really loved what you said at the end, because, like, I feel like I always felt so sad for Esther that she had to live with that pig for the rest of her life. You know, what an existence is that? But, like, knowing that she literally was a Kohen Gadol, it was just so reassuring that, you know, it was just beautiful. It almost brought tears to my eyes. It was very special.
That means I didn't go far enough. I should have gone further.
So can you tell me a little bit about that, when she, like, said no to, like, perfumes and stuff like that? Like, it was she trying... Was that anything to do with the Ketoret idea that you mentioned?
I believe it does. That her very essence, she is Hadas. But therefore, she doesn't want the artificial kinds of perfumes. Her essence is one of the Ketoret, which is total purity. Which means that's what we need to understand about her. And don't get confused what her body did. And that's why, you know, there's a fancy word for the whole book. It's called antinomian. The way of saying that in English is v'nahafachu. Everything is the opposite. Everything is the opposite of what you think it is. So therefore, again, Haman thinks he's destroyed the Jews, but he's really going to give the money to build a Beit HaMikdash. You think that Esther did something wrong with her body, you don't begin to understand what she did with her soul. So there's a lot of dangerous ideas in the book. It really is a dangerous book, and it's probably preferable when we teach kids when they're 5 years old and they think they understand it and it's much better. By the way, I have a long essay on the book, and I'll be happy to send it to you later. I'll send you a copy of the essay. Anybody wants it, send me a note.
One more question, unless someone else would like to precede me.
Go ahead.
So you argued that at the beginning that Ahasuerus was, quote unquote, also evil, kind of like Haman. But what Ahasuerus did was mostly out, I think, of self-aggrandizement. He thought he was the king of the world, and when the chips came down, he also turned against Haman because it was his ego and his, you know, reshus that he needed to protect. Now, it's interesting that Amalek is identified with Haman is irredeemable, right? But that the rest of Esav has some purpose ultimately in serving the Jewish people. So I think it's important to really differentiate the type of anti-Semitism or what the political expediency of Ahasuerus versus like the desire to obliterate like the Greeks later did, what the essence of Yiddishkeit was, which was really Haman, the spiritual is irreconcilable in the end.
Yeah, I'm going to be careful with my answer because I first of all, I like what you said. Secondly, I agree with what you said. All that I did is I identified one approach in the Midrash, which then just says that Haman is a more successful Ahasuerus. I'm not going to tell you that's the only, first of all, I'm not going to say that's pshat necessarily. That's not necessarily the straightforward reading of the text itself. And I'm also not going to say that that's the only voice that we find in the Midrash. But I said, this voice, when it says that he's wearing the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, then there's a stronger thing. Then the connection is a little bit stronger, at least I'm going to say, on that Midrashic level.
I mean, yeah, all right. Like, you know, you put a monkey in a suit, he's still a monkey. All right, I agree.
Okay.
You know what, there's a joke that the thing about the rat race is even if you win it, you're still a rat, you know?
Yes. Marika, is that your sister?
It is my sister.
How do you pronounce her name?
Afia. Hi there. I'm sorry for the very strange angle. It's that I have friends who've been staying with me so nicely. And so
okay. That's what I was... No.
So my question was, and yeah. This is a... I think it might not... It really probably is not going to have enough time to answer it. But yeah. I'm so curious on the question of Ahasuerus being a villain and the role of Vashti in this story. Because that was the one character I felt that wasn't like brought up. And I was curious if you had any thoughts on that. I've always been curious about her character. But anyways, any like preliminary thoughts? Because I know it's way too long of a conversation.
Yeah, one is I gave a talk 2 weeks ago on Vashti.
Oh, I'm sorry I missed it.
And Marika will give you the source, right? Okay. And I just now gave the content of that talk is in the link that I just now sent you, but it's worth listening to it because the whole thing's about Vashti. I agree with you. You cannot understand the rest of the book without understanding Vashti. She sets down the parameters, which means Esther is a Vashti replacement. Without understanding Vashti, you can't understand what Esther's really doing and the choices she makes and the choices she doesn't make. That's also important because she had choices. And I agree. And Raina, I agree that when you really understand the book of Esther, it's not just a happy book. When one thinks about Esther, one should cry. I agree with you completely about that. It does. The story of Esther, when I teach it, it generally brings tears to my eyes as well. Sometimes when I write things, this goes to back to one author to another here, that sometimes when I write things, people read it and say to me, you know, that really was very moving to me and I was crying when I read it. I said, yeah, I know, because I was crying when I wrote it. I mean, so that's that generally will go and transfer over.
Baba, I think for me, the more I learn about Purim over the years, and I said this last year, Purim really connects to every single Jewish holiday, whether it's the reacceptance of the Torah compared to Shavuot, Yom Kippur. It's connected to everything. It has a connection to Hanukkah, but I think what's the most fascinating is its connection to Pesach. And I know that you've talked in the past about Esther being the Korban Pesach that year, since the holiday of Purim happened really on
Passover Pesach. Right.
And I don't know if Ronnie's still here, but we had a class with Sammy and Ronnie and Raina a few days ago. And we were talking about next year when it's going to be a leap year and it's Adar Bet, when we celebrate Purim, it's kind of like the same way that the Beit HaMikdash was tithering between Binyamin and Yehuda. In a way, Adar Bet, that is when Pesach and Purim meet. That's when the two holidays really emerge as one, and I think it's extra holy. So for me, this year, we're not going to celebrate Purim in the way that we usually do. But I think we should all take the messages of Purim, and next year we got to elevate it even higher because it's going to be the holiest that it can be.
Okay.
on the subject of Esther not wearing the perfume, perhaps that's connected to the fact that the family who made the Taurus, their females didn't go out with perfume because people thought that they would be using the Taurus ingredients for their own personal use.
Right.
Perhaps some connection there.
Yeah, no, very nice. Very good thought. Okay. So everybody have a good morning, a good afternoon, a good evening, depending where you are. And thank you, Marika, for causing all this learning of Torah. But I'm shocked that we didn't get up to 300 people.
Well, it's easier when I can get people drunk and I can, get a DJ to get people to come out.
What was that?
Last year.
Yeah.
What?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, last year, right, I think my highlight was in the club when we had Purim on the LED screens, which were in like five different rooms. I figured out how to have Yud-Heh, Vav-Heh everywhere. And the next day the club was shut down. It's been shut ever since. So, it's easier when you have that type of power. But I think that getting this many people on a Sunday is still very impressive. And I'm
well, we could have people sign up in advance. And everyone has to buy, we would have sent them a bottle of wine or something, and we could have gone much deeper into Purim.
Yeah.